Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, overdosed on Keats, the salted taste of all your tears and woes, and a different drum is playing a different kind of beat.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
Well, good morning, Tapsters. As you can tell, I, Tony Slagle, am your host today. We're broadcasting, as we typically do, from the Vinegaroon Saloon. I'm joined, as I always am, by our humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Good morning, Tapsters.
And of course, Doug Cooper, who would be hosting, except this is his pick that we're discussing today. Doug?
Hello, everyone. It's nice to be here.
We have an alert. Alert. Ladies and gentlemen, do not panic. What's today, JM?
Why, I think it's somebody's birthday.
T? Hey.
Tony, do you know whose birthday it is?
Was Mick Jagger born on this day?
I don't
day?
Think he was born on this day.
One of his biggest fans was. That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, Tony Slagle is having a birthday.
And we're having his favorite birthday scone.
We're having his scones. Cecilia Nasty from NPR just dropped off some scones.
I didn't know you'd got those for my birthday, Jim. I apologize.
Well, JM's helping himself to one. He hasn't offered one to the birthday boy, though.
I'll have a piece of scone just to celebrate.
Tony's sitting there wishing it was a real blueberry muffin.
Thank you, JM.
You're nice welcome.
Tony, you're not pretentious enough to pretend like you like scones, are you?
I'm going to have to drink some water after this, everybody.
And yet.
Thanks, everybody. Yes, I turned 54 today.
Wow. Little pup.
I feel every bit of 54, to be honest with you. But anywho.
Age is just a number, says people who haven't turned. That's right. 50 yet.
Somebody told me yesterday that your 50s are your new 30s, and this was a person in their 30s. I went, Anyway. Yeah.
Well, are they in their teens?
Who knows? Well, thanks, everybody.
It's always nice to imagine that old age thing won't happen to you.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll eat right and keep myself in shape, and it won't happen to me.
I won't age.
It was funny. When you started playing the alarm, I thought you were going to steal my thunder, because I have something pulled up that I want to play.
Uh-oh. I hope you have a different alarm.
We have an intrusion. We have an intrusion.
That's right, everybody. That's our typical normal host, Doug Cooper, during our Creedence Clearwater Revival episode, where he said we had an intrusion because I had picked an album that was a blues-based rock band from 1970, whatever. And tonight we have an album by all accounts, I classified as a jangle pop band from 1983. And we're talking about the debut album by Aztec Camera, and that is Highland Hard Rain. And I am curious, Doug. I'm curious about a couple of things. First, let's just get the big question out. Why did you pick this album? And then I'll ask my follow-up.
Why did I pick this album? Okay, so this album was on the inevitable list. I imagine we all have an inevitable list in our head of albums we'll eventually have to cover. Mm-hmm. And being extremely sensitive to the opinion of others, I happened to notice that maybe I was getting typecast. And so just like John Wayne refused to be on Gunsmoke because he was afraid he would be typecast as a cowboy.
Yeah, that didn't work out too well, did it?
I decided time to break out of my shell. So I thought this is the most on 1971 album I could think of. And it's one I've listened to for a long time, and it is absolutely, if we were to stack my albums and organize them by genre, this one would be all by itself.
Well, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
And that's why I want to ask this follow-up question for you, and then we'll get into a little bit of our history with the band. But when did you stop? You have this the part of your... part of your history, if you will, or part of your legend, if you will, is that you stopped listening to music at a certain year and sort of lost track of what was going on in the popular
culture. It's really close. This came out in 83. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I graduated from high school in 83.
Okay.
And I think I went about maybe three or four more years, and then I walked into a bookstore that had recorded books that you could rent, and that was it, baby. So, plus, I was the same age as the people making the music, yeah. And they seemed preposterous to me.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of things.
Well, I'm curious about that because this is the third band we've talked about from this time period that you really dug. Two of them were your picks. One of them was my pick.
What were the others?
Big Country.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And U2.
That's right.
So it seems that you had a proclivity towards guitar, like new wave guitar based rock, because this is a guitar album in the same way that Television is a guitar album. Yeah, what I mean by that is it's
Television's a very guitar album.
But what I mean by that is neither one of these are traditionally considered guitar albums, right. I don't think, but they both of those are very, I mean, that's what is,
yeah,
makes them unique and makes the,
and those. If you like guitar music, you cannot ignore
right.
it. And yeah. So there is anything with a unique or exceptional guitar will grab my attention immediately. I don't know that this is exceptional, but it is unique.
It is
for an 18-year-old, it's exceptional.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that I'm distracted by when listening to this album is this was made by an 18-year-old.
Well, and some of the songs were written way before that,
right?
Yeah,
and one of the reasons it's been able to survive with me is I don't hear an 18-year-old.
No,
when I hear these songs.
No,
this is at the point where I had a subscription to Rolling Stone magazine,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and they were directing a lot of my buying. You mentioned Big Country. I saw their review of Big Country and immediately walked around, as a dyslexic, I was walking around asking for the band The Crossing, and I was looking for an album called Big Country, and nobody could find it. I was very disappointed. But this one I got right. And I read an article in Rolling Stone magazine where Elvis Costello said, "This guy's a fantastic songwriter." So my opinion of Elvis Costello as a songwriter couldn't be higher.
Right.
So when I heard that, I thought, okay, no choice. And just went and bought the album immediately.
And just real quick, Elvis Costello put his money where his mouth was. He had these guys open for him for an 8-week tour. Uh-huh. In the States, when they were nobody in the States really knew who the heck they were.
A lot of musicians really liked this band.
Well,
I mean, I've heard a lot of people that, you know, Elvis Costello, Mark Knopfler.
Mark Knopfler had it.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. But
Tony was just saying there's no connection.
Yeah, I forgot about that one.
Elvis Costello, Mark Knopfler so far.
What's interesting to me about this band is how much a couple of things. It's difficult to find any real, I had to dig to find any sort of historical background about these guys.
Yeah.
Secondly, almost to a person, people hold this particular, their debut album up very, very high. And then it's almost like it was lightning. Couldn't strike twice.
Yeah.
It's not that their other albums are considered to be poor They're just not considered to be what people think of this particular album.
Yeah. When I listen to the other albums, it's a strange thing because I'm not listening to them as an 18-year-old,
right,
like I did this one at first. Their other albums came out pretty much after I was done exploring music. And this album has two big problems, and at least, but for me, they're huge problems.
I think we'll all agree on at least one of them, probably.
We've already talked about both of these in other contexts, but the other albums don't have them. But the other albums also don't have this freshness, this where did that come from element that's clear on this one. And there's a lot of energy on this one. Mm-hmm. And there's optimism that it seems to me accidental optimism that pops up on this. Some kind of exuberance that someone trying to take themselves seriously would have tried to not let out, but it gets out anyway.
I think it has to do with his historical musical context, the stuff he listened to. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you dig into his history a little bit, the story a little bit, you realize he's kind of an outlier in the way he viewed the world. Maybe it might have been because he was so damn young when he was experiencing all this stuff. You know what I realized when I was pulling up Knife and Love?
The one that came right after.
Yeah, Knife or The Knife, I forget which it is, and Love are the two albums that came after this. It seems as if Roddy Frame, who's the main songwriter and guitarist, sort of slid into, and this is not a knock on him, it's just something I don't find that interesting, slid into like a Howard Jones type of place.
The synthesizer started becoming more prominent.
I think a Knife... Knopfler was digging synthesizers at that period. Yeah. That was did that come out about the same time as Love Over the Gold?
Yeah.
Because those two I can hear.
It's got Guy Fletcher on it too, mm-hmm. the guy that he brought in to play synthesizers and keyboards for the Dire Straits.
Well, and the other thing that happens after this album is essentially Roddy Frame is Aztec Camera. He starts, I think on the second album, the bassist follows him. And then after that, it's just him and a bunch of session musicians, but they're still calling themselves Aztec Camera.
Well, there's an album that came out, the last album they did as Aztec Camera, and Roddy Frame went solo after that. It's Frestonia. Mm-hmm. And that album, to me, was kind of a return to this kind of format, where the piano is, there's no synthesizers, and the piano is very prominent, and his guitar playing is very prominent again.
But in the darkness I could see the demons leave. They were the devils I had come upon in sleep. And as I made to sing, the devils spread their wings and sang like angels. So sweet. So when the
How are the drums?
The drums are much better.
Ladies and gentlemen, we might as well just clear this up.
Get the big elephant out of the room, in the room, out of the room.
There are some things that cause the devil to rejoice. a child who doesn't show respect to his parents, people putting beans in chili.
He looked at me when he said that, everybody, by the way.
Well, you don't eat chili, so you can't
eat chili. I just don't eat meat.
Yeah, then it's not chili. You're eating bean soup, and there's no foul. Oh, I like bean soup, too. That's fine. Go ahead. Enjoy yourself. Among the things that the devil... I'm sorry. We got a chicken walked into here. I think that's Reba.
Reba?
Yeah, Reba McIntyre. Huh. It's red chicken, so the wife names it Reba.
Makes sense.
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, the devil loves electric drums. And this is a period where a lot of good music came out, and a lot of it needs to be redone without the electric drums. I think a Lil Stevens' second album.
Yeah.
there's two things. He got political, which I don't need. But then he had those electric drums in it. And they go, if you don't know what we're talking about, they go,
pew, you'll know it when we play these songs. Pew. Rush also did that.
Like Photon Torpedo.
Rush did that too for...
Oh, yeah. Vapor Windows.
Or no. For Power Windows.
Power Windows, yeah.
I think maybe a little bit on Grace Under Pressure.
Yeah. It's such an unfortunate
song. Are they on every... They're not on every song on this album.
They're not. They don't interfere with every song on this
album. Well, and I will say this up front. I think they're extreme... So here's some advice from me for anybody who hasn't really listened to this album in a while or hasn't listened to it. Because it's a good album, don't listen to it with headphones on. You put the headphones on and the electric drums,
yeah,
just,
they come to the forefront.
Oh my, it's horrible. But if you listen to it without the headphones, they're not quite as noticeable.
Well, there is this genre of music that I guess they consider it new wave, but that, you know, I think of the bands like New Order, Ultravox. You know, who are these other Simple Minds, all these bands that I just, to me, the music just sounds cold, and it sounds like there's a predominant of this kind of sound, the drum sound, in a lot of those songs.
Well, the problem with using them on this particular album is it dates it in a way that the album might not otherwise be dated.
That's true. I think there's a couple of things that could have been done take this, make this album a little more timeless. The electric drums are one. And the other one we've already discussed is the Ovation guitar.
Yeah.
Which I didn't realize it until Tony made me realize it. But I hate Ovation guitars.
Well, they're not used on every song.
They're not.
They're not used by anyone anymore, thank God.
No,
but I don't know if anyone records with guitars anymore. They just...
Roddy Frame actually... says he used a different guitar on every song.
Yeah.
But the Ovation's definitely on the opening track.
Well,
he plays it in the video.
Well, he said that he had just got a brand new guitar, acoustic guitar, I think like 2 or 3 days before this album was recorded, and he was just enamored with the sound of the acoustic
guitar. Was it an Ovation?
No, it was some guitar I've never heard of, and if you try to look it up, you can't find it.
Yeah.
But Jam, tell the people about the Ovation so they understand what we're talking about.
Okay, Ovation guitars, I guess they came out in the 70s, and they have the back of them is not made of wood. The back
is a composite.
It's some sort of, it's like plastic or something. And it's really, the reason why they came about and the reason they got so popular is that they didn't feed back a lot. So they had really good electronics in it. The problem is they have such a tinty sound.
It's a real bright sound.
It's a bright sound.
It sounds artificial.
Popular. Yeah, it sounds like an electric acoustic.
Yeah, it sounds artificial to me.
And you know, a lot of musicians like them.
They were everywhere.
They were
at this period of time. Mm-hmm.
Watch Midnight Special. And you'll see.
They pop up all over the place. And the other thing was nice is you didn't have to treat them like a baby. You could bang them around. I remember Hart always had.
Yeah.
When I think of acoustic guitars, I think of what's her face Wilson. Which one's the dark haired one?
That's Ann.
Oh, anyway, she used to be really
well. You know, and
anyway,
you can't play them sitting. You can't play them sitting down either.
They slide off
of you.
But it's a sound that I didn't notice as much when it was going on, but they were bad.
They're not very attractive either.
No,
they're ugly guitars.
A lot of people like them. I mean, there's people that I know that absolutely think they're the most...
Well, there's a certain type of singer-songwriter of a certain age that still lugs an Ovation around, and you'll see them, and it's like, and you know exactly when they pull it out what kind of song it's going to be, and it's usually not very good.
It's probably about dolphins and
stuff. Oh, it's just the worst.
It's just like if you see a Taylor guitar...
You know they're Christian.
You know it's a... Christian youth leader.
Well, we actually had something recently. We saw someone playing a Taylor. It was absolutely the opposite of that. Langford.
Yeah, I was surprised.
John Langford from the Waco Brothers and the Mekons and a myriad of other bands plays a Taylor, and he's not what you would call a
Christian youth leader.
Yeah. No.
Did you ask him, what are you doing?
No.
You got the wrong guitar.
He just likes the way it sounds.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a couple of Martin and Gibson snobs talking about other people's guitars. But
I have a.
Those are the two things in this album that hurt and date it a little bit. And then I've got an issue with some of the backing vocals.
I agree with that as well.
I've got an issue with all the strumming is they recorded it twice and they
mm-hmm. yeah.
And I think it makes it a little mushy.
He thinks it made it more percussive doing that.
Well, I know he thinks that. Yeah. I read that too.
Yeah.
And he had some what is the thing he said about the way he played with the pick that made it sound more percussive. Yeah. Except he didn't say pick. He said
plectrum.
I said, shut up.
He called it a plectrum?
I think that's what he called it. Yeah.
I don't remember seeing that.
The guy is a good guitar player. He's a good guitar player, and he's a varied guitar player.
Like, yeah, that's
the reason this album is on the. I don't know if the two of you would have ever picked it, but the reason I've picked it and the reason it's here is because of the songwriting and the guitar playing. I think the songwriting is exceptional, both the lyrics and the tunes. I've got some problems with the production, and of course, I've already mentioned the two instruments that I would have banned from the studio.
So,
but given the fact that he's an 18-year-old, it's almost a miracle that this thing is as mature sounding.
It's very mature sounding. I'll tell you. I'll just jump in real quick since you said, yeah, I don't know if you guys would pick it. You know, when I showed up this morning, I gave Doug a hard time. I said, "How are you not a Smiths fan?" Because this is very Smithy, early Smithy sounding to
me. And see, that's what I had a problem with on this. And I still have kind of a bias towards that. You know, I just think of guys that listen to this with, you know, impossible haircuts and paisley shirts.
Well, there was some of that, but I don't hold that against him because I was one of those guys. But but what's interesting about that is, Doug, is you're not a Smiths fan just because you don't know much about them, right? I would say that.
That's
fairly ignorant about the Smiths.
The reason I have heard mm-hmm. the Smiths, but I have nothing to say about them. I have no information about them.
So,
and you played something just a moment ago, and I said, yeah, that does sound like this.
The reason I bring that up is because I'm a monster Smiths fan. First time I listened to this album is when you picked it.
Well, I got to be honest with you. We talk about our inevitable list, mm-hmm. And I wanted to stop being typecast. I'm about to retypecast the daylights out of myself, though, so this is a little brief. This may be the last time.
But you did pick the back album, too.
Yeah, that was not for the same reason. That was, this album's so good, I can't stop. I gotta spread the word. Anyway, one of the other reasons I picked this is I was listening to it, and I was saying, Tony would like this. Mm-hmm. This sounds like even hand claps.
You're absolutely right. I didn't know much about this band. I put this album on and I went, huh. And then I listened to it and then I listened to it again and I was like, huh. And then I wake up in the morning with a song stuck in my head. I was like, okay, I get this. I like
and
this.
And I think one of the things that will be interesting is I think Tony's going to like different things than what I like about it. So, especially since when I'm swimming in this water, this is like the only, I think I'm in a little pool and I'm in this giant ocean because this is the only music like this that I ever listened to.
Yeah. Wow. I keep going back to this. There's this in the mid 80s, there is just this genre of music that, I mean, I kind of made a dividing line between them. It's like the U2, the Cars, Gary Numan. I thought of that as new wave. And then there was this other band, other side that was, you know, like Depeche Mode, the Smiths, the Cure kind of was going. And I just, if you were in the Smiths category, I just wouldn't have anything to do with you.
How can you categorize Depeche Mode and the Smiths together? Oh, Depeche Mode's a synth rock band.
I know.
And the Smiths are a guitar rock band.
I think it's much more the image, that kind of cold, you know, Morrissey does not come across as warmest guy.
No, and I think the big difference between this particular album, and I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, sorry, but
the big difference between Highland Hard Rain and any Smiths album is Roddy Frame doesn't seem to have a mopey bone in his body. Morrissey is a mopey guy.
But he had that pasty, you know, if you ever saw him on MTV.
He did it up, but he was, goop, I mean, you got to think, of what time it was.
That's what I understand what JM's talking about. And I used to throw all those bands together in in a category, the title of which I cannot say on here, but it had a lot to do with being very European, or at least what Doug Cooper thinks is European, very style conscious, very into your hair, and
just not looking like you're effeminate ball in your life,
and like you're just
very effeminate.
You've been beaten up since. I mean, the kind of guy that immediately see him in junior high, and go, oh, why isn't someone beating him up? So they just look like that.
I'm not going to protest too much because obviously you were into this band, and they're categorized as that. And JM's picked an Echo and the Bunnymen album coming up, and you
they
can't
would
say,
be in that
"Oh my lord," they're probably more
in
so in that category than these guys are.
Well, see, I don't know how you that they're very close to the center of that category.
Yeah. But things are happening. I'm starting to change. I'm starting to this band New Order is pretty good. I like some of their songs. Well, I like the Smiths now.
See, I would put these guys in a camp with the Smiths. I put them in a camp with the Alarm.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Why do you do that? let's go back and I'm 18 or 17 and making these categories. So I've got Springsteen over here, who's going to the gym and playing baseball,
wearing a wife beater.
He's got a wife beater and his blue jean jacket with
you
the sleeves.
Strap your hands across his engine
so everybody can see his guns and all that. There's this muscular. You got Bob Seger's voice on one side. You got Mellencamp over here, ma'am, Heartland, all this kind of stuff. And then on the other side, you got these ladies over here with their little Spando ballet or whatever. What's this? Flock of Seagulls looking hair.
So
a lot of this doesn't have anything to do with the music. It has nothing to do with talent. It's just when you're in high school, you're making everybody go into their groups, and you got to be mean.
And
got the kickers over here that are looking at the freaks. So it's that whole deal going on.
In 1983, that's when I started really getting into Springsteen. I really started getting into Van Morrison, when I was really into those, the Bob Segers and.
But it was kind of America versus Europe.
What's funny about this, not that this is going to surprise anybody who's listening with the America versus Europe thing, but it's funny that we're all sitting around this table because I was one of those guys. Not in 83. I was 13 in 83, but in 85, I had the hair. I think I wore eyeliner for a little while.
This is being recorded, Tony.
I know that. I'm not embarrassed about it. I was a kid. I had moping around, all
not
that kind of stuff. That didn't happen till later. I was
you listen to that deep pressed mood.
But what was funny is I went from a metalhead to that. Yeah. I was a metalhead, pretty big metalhead, and I slid into listening to stuff like the Smiths and R.E.M. And R.E.M.'s not a European band,
they were.
But I would put R.E.M. in with the same thing, like Aztec Camera, that same musical.
So when you got a cassette, did you take out the liner notes and create your own package for it? Because it seems like that's what
this conversation reminds me of one of the an event in my life where I was duck hunting with some. Buddy of mine and his friends from Dallas. If you're not from Texas, ladies and gentlemen, you don't know. Like everybody else wears boots, and in Dallas they have loafers and stuff like that. And
with tassels on them.
Very high.
It's like Houston Memorial.
It's very, very stylish. They know what's in style and all that. Yeah. So I'm with all these Dallas guys, and we're hunting ducks on his place. And you're going to think I'm exaggerating because it's there's no way this could be true. But when we're finished, we're cleaning birds, and they put on Her Name Is Real. What's that band?
Oh, Duran Duran.
They put Duran Duran on.
That's a great album, by the way, everybody.
They're drinking wine coolers, and they're smoking clove cigarettes.
No way.
Sounds like me at 15.
It sounds like I'm making that up, but in my home, and if I only had members-only jackets on.
I had a members-only jacket, too.
The whole thing, it just sounds like, if you put it in the movie, people say, all right, that's a little too far. But it was true, and it was happening. I remember saying, if you guys ever tell anybody I was here with y'all, I'm going to call you liars.
It's really funny. You just described me. I smoked clothes. I drank wine coolers. I had a members-only jacket.
So anyway, all that's to say is it's very bizarre that we're doing this record because I understand.
Well, it's bizarre that you're picking it.
That's what I meant. Yeah. And it's I understand the categories that JM's talking about. And having said all of this, none of it has a thing to do with
what's
talent
yeah.
or
yeah.
anything like that. And now that I'm older and I see how silly all those lines were, I can appreciate it. Just like I like this prog stuff that I've heard about.
Yeah. So I think, guys, since I'm the host, I'm going to switch it anyway. I think we should probably talk a little bit about Roddy Frame and the history of the band, if you guys are okay with that.
I'm good with that.
And jump in anytime you want to, because it sounds like we all sort of saw the same stuff here, because it's a little difficult finding out a little information about these guys.
There's not a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's not a
whole
lot.
We're not actually doing Bobby Dylan.
No.
Yeah.
So he's born in East Kilbride, which is a suburb about 30 minutes outside of Glasgow. And the funny thing is he says that claim to fame of that town was it was the first town in the UK that had a shopping mall.
Is that right?
Yeah. So.
Oh, I forgot that. That's true.
His father worked for a government engineering laboratory unloading trucks. He was kind of a middle-class kid. Around 5 or 6, he becomes infatuated with Bowie. He loves David Bowie.
That doesn't surprise me.
He says at his age, he loved the songs, the chords, his words, and he said he looked like some sort of, whatever from Mars, and he was attracted to that.
Spider?
It wasn't a spider, something else. His sisters, who were older than him, brought in, they brought in the Beatles and the Hermits and stuff like that, and the Stones. He gets his first guitar when he's 9. Santa brought it to him. Aww. And he said, this is a funny story. He says he learned a couple of chords on it, and then he basically used it as a spaceship for his Action Man figure. And Action Man, I had to look this up. Action Man is essentially the UK version of G.I. Joe.
Oh, okay.
He's like an army guy.
Did he have Kung Fu grip?
I don't know about
I bet
that.
He but didn't.
He's using his guitar as a spaceship for this thing.
Somehow that afterwards. Doesn't surprise me.
He probably had a little tiny, what was that, P7? What did James Bond always have that tiny gun instead of 44 Magnum like Dirty Harry?
Didn't kick at all.
When he picks up he picks up the guitar again when he's 13, and what happens when he's 13 is punk rock hits the UK. And he hated school, so he saw the guitar as a way to distract him from that. It's interesting. When he's talking, Frame's an interesting guy because he doesn't have the same sort of mentality about stuff that a lot of people. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's probably because of his age. He said when he was when the punk rock sort of music hit the UK, it was frowned upon to be good at your instrument. I read someplace where evidently Mick Jones, who was pretty decent, faked being bad because it was seen as being cool to be bad at your instrument.
Yeah.
So,
boy, I could be cool now.
He said, if you picked up a guitar in 77 and you knew anything beyond 3 chords, it was seen as slightly distasteful. But because by 13, he had been, with his guitar, he'd been playing along with Mick Ronson, the Bowie stuff. Jeez. He was a big fan of Wilco Johnson, who was the guitarist for Dr. Feelgood. We've talked about Dr. Feelgood, the pub rock mainstays, Dr. Feelgood. Yep. He was a Django Reinhardt fan.
Really?
At this point.
I can see that.
And Wes Montgomery.
Oh, Wes Montgomery.
He's digging the jazz chords.
Yeah.
You can tell that.
You can tell that too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely can tell that. And so guitar, he wanted to be good at the guitar. He didn't want to have this sort of, I'm going to feign whatever. And he was just crazy about it. And while he wasn't somebody who embraced the whole, disdain for talent side of punk, he really did. The scene excited him. So when punk happened, it was a big thing because he was into glam before that, and that always seemed otherworldly to him. Like it was not touchable to be able to he as a 13-year-old being in a glam rock band wasn't doable, but being in a punk rock band was. So he, of course, thinks it's that whole DIY punk aesthetic that anybody can do it. You can form your own band. So he writes his first song when he's 13, and he says it's the archetypal punk protest song. And then around 14, he starts a band called The Forensics, which was a punk band he was in. That band didn't last very long. At 15, he forms another band called Neutral Blue. And this is around 1979, and the punk scene in the UK is essentially a bunch of dying embers at that point. And you've got all these what are classified as post-punk bands kind of coming out of that.
Gary Numan and Tubeway Army and
Yeah, and he said, you know, and just talking briefly about what we talked about, what he's into, his tastes were always beyond that whole punk thing anyway.
Yeah.
So he said his songwriting really changed the first time he heard The Fall. And he hears a song called It's a New Thing on John Peel, and he said he never heard anything like that before, because here's a guy who was singing about the computer center down the road or eating a packet of crisps or things that you felt like were directly coming from his daily life. So he's like, I think I can do that too. And he starts getting into this new wave post-punk stuff. Bands like Joy Division, who you mentioned earlier, JM, Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes. Yeah. He gets into all the stuff they're doing.
I was about to say, I wonder if he got into Joy Division. I can hear.
Oh, no. In fact, there's a song on this album, or a song that he wrote, was specifically trying to be a Joy Division type song. He also said it was interesting whenever he'd pull a 12-string out on stage, people would look at him like, what the heck is that? Because acoustic guitars weren't considered a thing, and especially a 13-year-old or a 16-year-old, I should say, playing an acoustic guitar. That seemed like an odd thing, especially a 12-string. Anyway, because his musical his tastes are changing, he leaves Neutral Blue, and he takes the drummer of the band, David Mulholland, along with him. And he forms a new band with David Mulholland on drums and a guy named their initial bassist, Alan Welsh, on bass. And that band is Aztec Camera. You guys know where the name came from?
I don't.
I know, and I'm wondering.
And I've wondered that for a long time, and because I don't have a very good power of concentration, I always forget to look it up before I...
It's not a brilliant story, but Frame says he picked the name Aztec, or the term Aztec, because, quote, it sounded right. I don't know what that means. And Camera came from a Teardrop Explode song. I also read that he was listening, at the time he was listening to bands like the 13th Floor Elevators, but he was also listening to Echo and the Bunnymen, and he just wanted to have an equally ridiculous name like those bands had, so he came up with Aztec Camera. So again, not anything super...
Well, you can hear a lot of Aztec in his music.
Yeah,
a lot of those pipes that they
so
the pan flute. I think that's further south, Jay.
The pan flute.
quit putting all Native Americans into one single group. That's highly offensive.
Anyway, if you poke around online a little bit, you can see the general consensus, and I think this might even be on their Wikipedia page, that Aztec Camera made their recorded debut on a 1980 cassette compilation of Scottish bands released by Pungent Records that was also in association with a Glasgow-based Fumes magazine called In and Out of Fashion. That is, in fact, incorrect. And we here at Vinyl Tap want to set the record straight.
That's right. Because we get accused of being incorrect frequently, but... When we're accused of being incorrect, it's usually because we're correcting the common knowledge that is incorrect.
That's right. Their debut was on cassette, and it was released by Pungent Records in association with Fumes magazine, but it was on a cassette called Urban Development. And there was another collection of Scottish bands, and they had three songs. Aztec Camera had three songs on the cassette. They had Abattoir, Stand Still, and Real Tears. And I'm going to play a bit of Stand Still for you guys so you can hear what early Aztec Camera sounded like.
Not a rock.
If you had told me that was a Joy Division outtake, I would have believed you.
That is Stand Still by early song by Aztec Camera.
That was not a 12-string guitar. No. That was a 1-string guitar.
That was a bass and sort of drums.
So this compilation brings them to the attention of a local Scottish label called Postcard Records. A Postcard is formed in 79 by Alan Horn and Edwin Collins. And they formed it really as a means to promote local Scottish bands, post-punk bands that they were listening to and into. The tagline was "The Sound of Young Scotland." Unfortunately, the label only lasted a couple of years, but one night Aztec Camera's opening for the Rosillos at this place called the Bungalow Bar. And this is in December of 80. And Alan Horn sees them, and he signs them a couple of days later to this Postcard Records. They're the fourth act to be signed to Postcard. The fantastic Australian band, the Go-Betweens, was one of the acts. And then two Scottish bands, Joseph K and Orange Juice, were signed by them. During their time with Postcard, they issued two singles. The first one was Just Like Gold, which was backed with We Could Send Letters. That song reached number 10 in the UK independent singles chart. The second single they released was Mattress of Wine, which was backed by Lost Outside the Tunnel. That song, that single gets attention from John Peel, who we've talked about before, especially in the T-Rex episode. That song reaches number 8 on the same chart. And there's a planned album to be with Postcard called, it was I think tentatively called Green Jacket Gray, but that was scrapped. Around this time, Mulholland leaves the band and he's replaced by John Hendry on drums. In 81, the British music rag New Music Express, or NME as it's otherwise known, releases a compilation cassette in conjunction with Rough Trade, the label Rough Trade, called C81. Cassette 1981, essentially. And the goal of that was to mark the first 5 years of the independent label movement in the UK. And it included an acoustic version of Aztec's Camera, We Could Send Letters. So
that's a good song.
It is a good song. In May of 82, Frame is feeling a little less than happy about the way Postcard is promoting them. And he's looking for something to be a label that would give them a little bit more, you know, splash out there in the world. Jeff Travis from Rough Trade gets in touch, and the band ends up relocating to London and signs with after they sign with Rough Trade. Frame is interesting. He says that Postcard, the whole charm was that groups couldn't tune their own guitars under that label, and that was seen as charming. And this is a quote from him. He says, "I didn't see it as charming. I thought it was crap."
Meaning they were so they were such amateurs that they couldn't do the basics.
Yeah. Mm. So Rough Trade releases their first Aztec Camera single, Pillar to Post. It hits number 4 on the indie charts. Around this time, drummer Dave Ruffy ends up replacing Hendry, and the band sets out to record their debut album. And joining the band for those sessions is a guy named Bernie Clark on piano and keys. Clark also, I believe, co-produces the album along with John Brand. And Frame says at the time they were shooting this point at Aztec Camera, he was shooting for a sound that was reminiscent of the Byrds, the Velvet Underground, and Love. And we've talked about all three of those bands podcast.
Indeed.
Yeah. So Aztec Camera records their debut studio album at International Christian Communications Studio. Do you know anything about that studio?
I know. I tried to find something about it.
I wrote that down because I think that may be a non-connection. I don't think we've ever talked about this studio before. Most of the studios we've talked about by now.
Yeah.
But I've never heard of this before.
Never. Uh-huh. They recorded in 3 weeks. Frame says they felt rushed, but he thought that was a good thing because it gave them a bit of pressure in the studio, and he feels like that comes out on the album. It sounds a little...
I think first albums are frequently rushed because they don't have a budget usually.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of benefits that have come from...
Well, he even says that he thought they benefited from it being rushed. And
To keep somebody from noodling around too much or trying to figure out... I'm sure that if you're making your first album or any of the Prove Yourself to the World albums, you're wanting to make everything absolutely perfect. And I think a lot of those decisions made in the studio, I was in the studio when an album was being made, and I can remember them agonizing over this or this. And if you step back, you say, no one's going to care. And there's probably three other ways you could do it that would be just as good. And I think if you don't have the budget, sometimes that pays off.
I mean, I obviously never been in a studio, but I'm guessing that the tension there is between what you say, nobody's going to care, but the fact that the artist cares. And so they're trying to find out.
Well, the producer's got his hand in there. And then sometimes you have people who are on the clock, and they're always in favor of doing it again.
Of course. Yeah. We mentioned this before. They double tracked it was a Masano was the type of acoustic guitar.
I don't know anything about that.
I don't either.
And he had gotten, that's the one he got 2 months before the guitar. They double track that. Yeah. He said the acoustic feel of the album wasn't intentional. He just started using acoustic guitar and he was, but he realized that it was not what everybody else was doing at the time. So it's made them stand out a little bit because everybody else was.
I think it has a lot to do with the reason Doug Cooper paid attention to it.
Right. Yeah. It sounded fresh and refreshing to him. So
and we talked about how that freshness can be introduced to an album by the acoustic guitar when we're talking about Dave Mason's album. How I think it's an underused trick.
Anyway, that essentially brings us up to this album, Highland Hard Rain, which was released in April of 1983.
And here we discover one of the benefits of reviewing a debut album.
How quickly we got to it.
The history is truncated.
The LP included, they had released it as Oblivious as a single. The follow-up single was Walk Out to Winter. And then they re-recorded versions of Pillar to Post, We Could Send Letters, and Lost Outside the Tunnel to include on the album.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody find anything out about the album's cover?
No. I didn't see anything about the cover. There's a lot. I do too.
I don't know. Is this called primitive art or something?
Jam. I would think Jam would like it because it seems very Brian Eno-y to me.
It does look kind of Eno-y.
Oh, Lord. I'm the one who mentioned Brian Eno, not Jam.
Wow, ladies and gentlemen. You don't get to drink.
The very first song on the album is not Obvious. It's Oblivious.
Oblivious. That sounds so much like something I wouldn't listen to.
It does sound like something you wouldn't listen to. I like this song. I mean, I remember when this song came out on MTV. That's when I saw Roddy Frame, and that's where I said, this music isn't for me. But
it's a weird video.
It is.
I'm glad I never saw the video. The
video's very weird.
Yeah, it's got like just picture, and he's in a treehouse.
He's in a treehouse. He's got like pale pancake makeup on.
Yeah,
there's some voodoo guy in it too, and he's strumming on that Ovation like it's going out of style.
And there's no connection between the song. If there's a connection between the song and what's going on in the video, it's not evident at all.
Yeah, I do want to talk just briefly because I've mentioned this before. I think the bass, bass is important on this album. And and you listen to the song, the bass is pretty funky and it drives the song.
It does drive the song.
You know?
It's a little busy for me. And it's also played with a plectrum, which also...
the bass is playing with a pick, huh?
Yeah,
that's automatic.
One of the great divides in rock and roll.
That's already a demerit, but whatever.
They have like battles over that where bassists are actually killed?
Well, the two...
Paul
McCartney plays with a pick.
The greatest bassist in rock and roll never played with a pick.
Geddy Lee?
No. I love Geddy. He's the second best bassist in rock and
roll.
John Entwistle.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, he couldn't look smug and play with a pick. He has to act like, I don't even know what that hand's doing.
Well, he may not.
It's just going...
Anyway, you mentioned the background vocals, with the background vocals. I got a little bit of a problem with background vocals on this song.
It's too much.
It's too much.
There's a little...
Of course, this song is conspicuous on the album. This was I Want to Hit.
Yeah,
this is, well, he wrote it for that purpose,
and it's very evident that he's making a hit here.
Yeah,
and I don't like this song very much. I don't hate it.
I don't mind the song.
I like the song.
It's interesting that there's. I was going to say this in another song, but I'll just say it now. The weird thing about most of these songs on this album is I don't know. Even after listening to it, I don't know where they're going. They surprise me a lot. And so the chorus sort of comes out of nowhere.
Right.
It's an earworm. It bites you and bounces around in your head. But it's listening to the verses, you don't see that coming ever.
Well, there's a theme. I mean, this is something he does especially on this album, and I guess Knife is the next one, where it does sound like it's just cobbled together pieces. And it's like I get the feeling that he didn't actually write a song. He wrote pieces and he put them together.
Well, he was a young kid. Yeah, that makes sense.
Freaking 18
you know
years
what
old.
You know what song this the guitar riff is based on?
No.
Maybe the People Would Be the Times or Between Clark and Hilldale by Love.
By Love.
Well, and I went back and listened to that song and listened to this. And I was like, I guess I can kind of see that, but I was really straining to find out where
that
came from.
It was based on that. One thing that occurred to me is this is like Love.
Uh-huh.
In that you have musical modes that don't belong in this genre.
Right.
And you also have heavy acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those are a lot like the Love album.
Yep.
And I'm not surprised he was influenced by Love. I am surprised he's influenced by Love because I'm a little surprised an 18-year-old in 1983 had heard of Love.
Well, I think he...
Owe it to his sisters?
No. He came to it just like a lot of us do when we're that age. A musician he admired, I don't remember who it was, had mentioned that he was into Love. And he's like, oh, I'm going to go check this out. I think the guy was also into Zappa and some other stuff. And so he started digging into that stuff, you know. I mean, it's the whole reason I bought the Trout Mask replica was because Zappa was praising it and he produced it. And
yeah.
I'm not still working on that
yeah,
one.
I'm still working on that one. Anyway,
Love was 67.
Remember, it was yeah. We talked about that, the demise of the Summer of Love.
And it wasn't very Summer of Lovey.
No.
But the. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know about that record, you should listen to our podcast on that one. It's an exceptional album.
Yep.
That is not like anything else.
No, nope, right. It really isn't. So you're right about this being written to be a hit, and it essentially is. The weird thing about this album, though, is when they switched labels, they left Rough Trade after this album, went to WEA, and that album re-released this single, and it actually reached number 18 on the chart. I think I hit number 47 or 48 when it was released on this album. When they released it as a single after they joined WEA, it hit number 18.
Oh, really?
It went up.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway.
Well, if you listen to it, you said don't listen to this album with headphones because you will hear a bunch of stuff that you don't necessarily. Like, I hear the drum machine going through this. But there's also this really cool keyboard line that's in it that it's not real
evident,
but it's like a marimba sounding thing. And it's
I found that a lot listening to these songs, that the keyboards are sort of, they should be higher
should
up
be
in the mix
because
they're interesting. And you're not,
Yeah, there's some really cool keyboard work on this. And I guess the next to last song, you can hear more keyboards. But yeah, and it's odd because if you listen to some of his older, the albums after this, the keyboards do start becoming
not to bring up Brian Eno again, he was a big Roxy Music Brian Eno fan. So he also used to think it was ridiculous that people would disparage keyboards because he saw them as a very valid form of musical expression.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. I think Roddy Frame seems to me like somebody we've talked about a lot. I think he gets bored.
Yeah.
And he wants to do different things.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't want to stay in the same. And these songs, by the time they recorded this album, some of these songs have been with him for a pretty long time. And he was only 18, but when you're 18 and you're looking at songs you wrote when you're 14, 15, that seems like years and years apart.
I don't think I ever written a song when I was.
I don't think I've ever written a song. I've never written a song, and definitely not any as good as this when I was 16 years old. So, all right.
It's just, not quite sure what creates this kind of confidence in an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
I'm aware of confidence in an 18-year-old, but it's usually
bravado.
Yeah, preposterous too.
Yeah.
But this album doesn't. It sounds like a real live adult.
It does,
and I mean a real adult, 30 years old or something.
Yep. All right, I'm going to move on to the next song, "The Boy Wonders."
Some friends from my traveling.
I really like that song a lot.
I like it takes a little while for it to get going, but once it hits that chorus, it's great.
Well, he's got that very rapid strumming going on. Yeah. It makes me suspicious that it's sped up. I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't think so.
We didn't really focus on this much, but being that they're a Scottish band, this to me is the most Scottish song.
It does sound like that.
I mean, even the way it starts off with the kind of marchy drums underneath that high sped up.
Yeah,
it also has Hogmanay in it.
It does have Hogmanay in it, which is New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve.
It's when they party.
and
it sounds like it's not like our New Year's.
No,
it sounds like it has added meaning
when that chorus kicks in though. Oh, it's just as tuneful and wonderful
well,
as
well, and
could
how it gets
be.
To that and how it gets to that chorus with those hand
builds.
Claps it,
you have the core, they have the pre-chorus, which
I was
going
to talk to you. There's a lot of songs on this album that have pre-chorus.
That's I suspect he consciously does that, and I think nothing helps build towards a chorus like the pre-chorus. That just provides energy, and it's one other way to keep the song from getting old before it's over.
This is one of those songs I think would be fun live to see them do,
because
I think the crowd would be bouncing and pumping their hands up
singing
in the air
along.
And singing along
and
with
then
it.
You got the, that's where you get the name of the album
right at
that's
the right. end this when they're is, chanting it
yeah
the chant Hard Rain?
Yes.
Which
it's got hand claps in it too.
Yeah, it's got
it's
your
got
hand claps.
Tony's hand claps.
I also like the little switch on the chorus where he says where he's talking about Boy Wonder's plural, like this group of things, and then it switches to him personally. So it's Boy Wonder's plural, and then this boy. Then the wonders is a verb after that. I don't know. It just seems kind of clever to me.
Yeah, he's a clever.
He's a good songwriter.
He is a good songwriter.
I have a good feeling this is some sort of coming of age song by a guy who's usually coming of age songs are written by people who have come of age and are looking back.
It's definitely a coming of age song.
And it's but it's so optimistic.
Yeah.
I mean, you were talking about the Smith boy who's all moany and groany, and that's not here.
No.
Well, you know, I don't claim to have lived in this guy's head, but it's not. I mean, at 18, he's got a record career or a music career. He's already been lauded in the music press as kind of the next big thing. But he doesn't necessarily have an ego about it, but he's sort of positive about it. I get that's kind of refreshing, you know, in a lot of ways.
One thing I regret is I didn't get to see very many interviews of him when he was older. I'd like to see that. The interviews while he's younger, I can hardly understand.
Yeah, I can hardly understand.
This isn't big country. This guy.
Yeah.
This guy hasn't been in the big city long enough.
He's got a pretty big brogue. Yeah.
And for people like us without accents to hear to hear that's difficult.
That's funny. Yeah. Do you have anything to say about the one knock this band has or got when they first came out was they called them a little precious, you know, because of, I guess, the sound and the fact this guy was 18 and kind of his optimistic viewpoint. I don't see that at all.
But I can understand why.
Well, the music would, press, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just him. He looks so delicate, especially when he was this
year. The music sounds delicate. And the intro to the next song, I think I understand what they're talking about. That sounds like something I would say, and not in the music press, but there's an element, there's an effeminate element to this album. And if that's what they're talking about, I understand that. But I think when you get deeper into it, that goes away.
Yeah, I think it was probably just a general, I think you're probably right. I think that's what they're going on, this sort of not, you know, muscly masculine sort of approach to
like
music.
The Clash.
Yeah.
The Clash would not be precious. No. And of course we'll get to this if he's in the Clash fan club.
Yeah. Well, this next intro is
precious.
Well, and then, but the next song is about punk. So let's get into it. Walk Out to Winter.
Walk out to winter. Swear I'll be there. Chill will wake you high and dry. You wonder why. Met in the summer.
What a catchy little song.
It is a catchy song. The chorus is amazing, I think.
It's my favorite song on the album.
There are three songs that vie for that, and this is one of them for me, definitely.
I think we have to play the chorus, though.
Okay.
Everybody will be humming this for the rest of the day.
I can't
help but sing it the way he does. Walk out the winter.
Okay, let me.
It's like Doris Day almost.
Let me get to it.
This sounds like what they're for to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think the band is doing something unique and also something that they're particularly skilled
at. You know what? I wish there's a little more production on this song. To me, it suffers a little bit because it seems like there could be so much more that you could do with this song. And it seems like they've kept it a little too confined. And I think that they did something. We'll get to that song later. We're at like, okay, this is what they should have done on Walk Out to Winter.
I was just thinking I would remove the second track of the acoustic guitars.
It's interesting. You know, we all have different viewpoints on stuff, and I don't think I ever listened to this album once and thought, you know what this needs is more production.
I didn't think that. I don't. Sometimes I fantasize about it.
When you listen to the last song on this album, which is another song that vies for my favorite song on the album, and I wish there was a little bit more of that sometimes, you know.
Yeah,
but yeah, this song is about the death of punk, and Frame said in an interview the song wonders where all the young miserableists of his generation will go when they don't have punk to lean on.
How old was he when he said that?
I don't know.
It's pretty insightful.
And I think that's what that lyric about faces of Strummer that fell from your wall. That's obviously a reference to Joe Strummer.
Right. Yeah.
And he said that there, when he was writing this sort of jumble of influences. So there's punk, obviously, and then Wes Montgomery, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. and Django, and soul. He said he took the chord progression from "Ain't No Mountain High Enough" for this song.
I can imagine. Yeah.
So. The synth drums are unfortunate.
That's I think I was saying the production, but I think the engineering a little bit on this song might be what it is. It sounds too. Contradict myself. It sounds like everything's kind of mushed together, and it should be a little bit more soaring, like those instruments pulled like apart a little bit more.
I would like some emptiness in there. His voice. This sounds like what his voice is particularly good at.
I agree with that.
That chorus is soaring like a bird or something, the way that sounds.
And you can hear those little jazz inflections on his guitar when he's playing it. This song also sounds very Smiths-like to me. It's the one that every time I heard it, I would hear the Smiths on it.
I guess I can hear that.
This was the third single, and it reached number 3 on the indie charts. So there you go.
Good song.
How old was indie as a genre at this time?
Maybe I don't know, 3 or 4 years,
seems like
maybe old new. maybe more than that, probably 79.
I was gonna say 78, 79 when that kind of indie.
All right,
movie. I always thought it meant back then. I thought this doesn't sound Indian to me.
Well, you know what, I always thought the same thing with alternative. The thing that more than anything, it was like college radio. That was what it was. It was college radio charts, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And band you go see in a club rather than an arena.
And alternative is a problem when it became mainstream.
Anywho.
To REM.
All right. Next song, The Bugle Sounds Again. No bugle in the song, though, I don't believe.
I didn't hear one.
So here we go, Nighthawk calls again, meeting after midnight like we do. Flashback, never scared, know their kind too well. Ride that crash before the truth is time. You whisper to me as it.
How is this an 18-year-old guy?
I have no idea.
This song sounds so much more mature than an 18-year-old singing.
Yeah, it does.
One thing I read, it sounds like he's talking to his muse.
Yeah, I read that too.
And he's getting ready. It's time to go to bed, but time to write a song.
Got to get at it. Yep.
So this is not the way an 18-year-old's brain's supposed to work.
And this is the first real ballad on this album.
Yeah.
And I think it shows these guys are more than capable of pulling this off. I mean, I don't think there's a miss on
it. It's not just a ballad. It's a ballad about something other than a girl, so attractive to
me. I music.
I get it.
It's, again, the production drives me a little. The engineering's a little thin. That guitar gets on my nerves.
I was just liking it a whole bunch.
I don't like the way it's mic'd or something. It's just some sort of jangle to it.
I love this song. I think it's great.
It's a great song.
You like jangly guitars?
I do like jangly guitars.
The bass. I think there's even a mistake in the bass line.
Is it too jangly?
Jangly bass? That would be a trick. Do you consider this jangle pop, Tony?
This album?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's more than that. I think that's sticking it into a bucket and sort of narrowing the scope of it, because there's jazz, inclinations on this.
What about sophisto pop?
Maybe, yeah. I mean,
have you heard that word before?
No.
I just heard that for the first time, and I think I filled up two of these buckets with puke after I read that.
I mean, it's definitely jangly, but again, that's pigeonholing it in a way that I think does a disservice to this album.
I think the chords are too complicated for it to be a jangle pop album.
There's something transparent. sometimes you can see the author poking through in a book you're reading, and you can see his fascination with new chords.
Yep.
And
yeah.
That's very evident on this album.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But a great song.
Yep, yeah, I agree. All right.
Speaking of great songs,
We Could Send Letters is next. It's a shame we're not getting to the chorus, but because this is a prime example to me of his sort of unusual song structure. Like, this song does not, when the chorus hits, it's like, where in the heck did that come from?
Even in the little part we heard,
where it goes down,
you think, oh, I know it's coming in, the bum bum. It's kind of a cliche, that bass going dun dun dun, and you go, okay, I know, and then nope. You were wrong. Let's go to the chorus, though. You're right. Just close your eyes again until these things get better. You'll never fall away.
So you said earlier that, I forget what song it was. Was it Boy Wonders, that this is what they're for? This is what this band is for? I think this is another song.
This is my favorite song on the album. And it does so many different things. I mean, it's almost like a mini suite, It's
Well, we have another pre-chorus, which sets up the chorus perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you listen to the beginning and the chorus, you say, there's no way it's the same song.
15 years old when he wrote this.
Yeah.
That's amazing. 15.
And that acoustic.
You said you're free for me, that says it all. You're free to push me and I'm free to fall. Yeah.
That's great. The acoustic solo in this song is great too. The only issue is the drums.
The drums are the only, if they could just take out that, especially that one roll that he does, it just unnecessary. And just why? Why leave it in there?
I still would like a spare production. I'm distracted trying to figure out who I would like to produce this album, and I haven't come to a conclusion.
Rundgren? It's a joke.
I don't
Steve
know.
Steve Lillywhite. I wish Steve Lillywhite would have gotten
it. He might have been a good choice.
Yeah, Steve Lillywhite, I think, would be good. Yeah. Anyway.
He should do everybody's album, I think.
Yeah, it's a fantastic song.
The bass on this is really, I guess that's a fretless bass that he's playing through this.
Oh, maybe, yeah. And
that swooping sound.
And this is the last song on side one.
And it seems like the last song.
It does. It's perfect. I mean, so far, I think in general, the way this song, this album is sequenced works really, really well.
Yeah, I agree.
I think this album is almost without flaw, except for the things we've talked about regarding the production and the instrument choice, and Oblivious is a little too much
precious
for me. It's just...
Is that also the song you've heard the most, too?
No.
Okay.
JM said it was a hit, and I didn't know that. I always guessed that Walk Out to Winter would have been the hit.
Yeah.
But well, I didn't hear any of this on the radio.
I mean, Walk Out to Winter hit number 3 on the indie chart, so it was a hit for them. But
I was never involved in the indie thing. So
all right. Well, now we're gonna flip the album over and go to Pillar to Post.
You know who this song reminds me of? Another one of those bands that I kind of dismissed, The Style Council.
Well, you know, here's the funny thing about this particular band. I don't know how, I mean, you don't hear many people talk about how influential this first Aztec Camera album was.
Yeah.
But my guess is it was extremely influential. I think it influenced The Smiths. I think it influenced Style Council. I think it influenced a lot of these bands that were trying to, I mean, Style Council is Paul Weller, from the Jam, but he'd been doing it for a while. But I think that sound, that what they were going for, I think it did. I think you're right.
It's got that kind of Motown sort of soul factory.
Well, what's funny about this is Frame says he was trying to sound like The Clash on this song.
Are you serious?
I can kind of hear it. Maybe
some of their horn driven stuff.
I mean, it's a little.
He's not good at sounding like The Clash.
No, he doesn't.
But I understand what he's saying.
Yeah.
I almost feel like someone's scratching the chalkboard at the beginning.
It's not a good intro.
With the drums.
The drums are horrible.
Oh. The drums are horrible.
It just reminds
but
me of
once
a lot
once the song gets kicking, they're less a distraction than they are in the beginning.
It is.
But it's hard to return from that because that first intro is like, oh,
yeah. This song takes another one that takes a little while to get going. But once it gets going, it's a great song.
Yeah, the guitar is really nice. Yeah. The chorus practically saves the song in a lot of ways.
I guess it's very electric. This is the most electric sounding.
Yeah.
It's a good song.
It is. It's just like that intro leaves something to be desired. Namely, turn the drums off.
And well, this was released as a single too.
It was.
Listen to the guitars on the harmonizing guitars on the chorus. That is really, again, 18-year-old kid coming up with that. It's pretty spectacular. Really amazing.
And Pillar to Post means you're always on the move. You're being forced to go. From here to there.
Oh,
yeah. I don't recognize that expression. That may not.
I know a lot
across the pond.
No, there's some Texas home inspectors.
Pillar to Post.
They're pillar to post home.
And I think what they mean is they check everything.
So they're not using it the same way.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you're an expert on old sayings that are being misused in Texas, please let us know about that.
All right. So moving on to song two on side two, Release.
Get what you deserve. But hope held out its hands today. You laughed and turned and fled. Release, because I wanted the world. All I could get to was a gun or a girl. Release, now I've thrown them away. Here when I'm hungry and I hope I can stay.
This is another song that takes a while to get going, but once it does, it you know, you got that kind of Ink Spots beginning, you know.
It's an once the instrumentation on this song is an absolute pleasure to listen
to. Yeah, yeah. I wish that it seems like you could have put some harmony vocals or something on that intro where you, like I said, the Ink Spots, but I really think you
I could like have it did, just the way it
I
is.
I do too. I don't think, I mean, listen to this album, there's background singers, but there's not much harmony on this album anywhere.
No. I just think you could have done something like a doo-wop thing in the back.
He could have, but what I like is that I feel like I go, oh, finally, this is what a little bit of what I've been looking for.
Yeah, I agree with you, Doug. I think, and the song does get, I mean, it's not that it's not interesting. It's wonderful at the beginning and then the instrumentation, but as it sort of gains momentum as the song goes through.
It turns into almost a bossa nova kind of.
The beginning of the song and the end of the song sound completely different from one another.
And then here's another example of all of this doesn't belong in this genre, whatever this genre is.
No, I agree with you.
He's way outside of...
There are people that I've talked to that said this is their favorite all-time Aztec Camera song.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a great song.
Yeah. I bet if you go to his house and he sits down and picks up a guitar, he starts doing this a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's like, oh, have you heard this chord? Listen how this
he's
one
always
moves
astonished.
Into this
yeah,
one.
It's like he's astonished with these chords that he's just learning.
Well, I am too. I just can't play them.
No, but you're absolutely right. You hear the song and you think, wait a minute. This is supposed to be an indie alternative jangle pop band. Where is this coming from?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And how competent is that singer in the he's singing very well in that mode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost like a competent jazz singer. You got one of those guys that would be in the male vocalist section of your local record store rather than the pop.
You got to think
almost a Nat King Cole. Yeah.
You got to think when this album came out, reviewers are like, "Huh?" Like, this probably shook them to their core. Like, they weren't expecting, especially if you were following this band's career and hearing what they'd done before. Mm-hmm. And then there's other songs on here that are absolutely jazz influenced, you know? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call them jazz, but they're jazz influenced. And they're going, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. You know, it probably just, I didn't know what to do with it. But anyway. All right, moving on to the next song, Lost Outside the Tunnel.
Probably my least favorite song on the album.
Really?
Yeah. I just think it there's too many changes in it. They just sound jarring to me. And it takes a while, but about two-thirds of the way through the song, it starts seeming like it get the band starts gelling, but it just takes a while for it to get started, and I don't like the chord progression, and just very it's a hard song for me to get through.
It's an old Neutral Blues song he played when he was in that band. It's funny I never thought about it until we were listening to it just then. I could hear love in that song.
Yeah, I could hear.
I don't mean like All You Need Is Love. I mean the band Love. You could hear it in that song. It's a little bit more upbeat than their stuff. You know, yeah, a lot of their stuff is much more sort of minor chordy and stuff. But I could hear it there.
I believe in magic. That weird song off of.
What has that weird? What do they do? The seventh at the end of every line that Love does. He's doing something similar out here. Yeah. And but I do like the way this never becomes sing-songy. Mm-hmm. It is jerky, and it is it maintains my attention because of that.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
I like it too.
Yep. All right, moving on to Back on Board. You know what? I was trying to figure out how I describe this song, and the goofy term I came up with was new wave blue eyed soul.
He knocked it out of the park with this song. This is my second favorite song on the album. It's got that kind of sea shanty sing along at the end of it, which I really like. And it's got this is where I think the backup vocals are
they work here. Yeah, they're perfect for the song. His vocals are really, really great on this song as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
The keys are good on this song.
Yeah, the keys are great on it. Yeah. I love the organ on this.
Yeah, I do too. It works perfect for what this song is.
I think
I'm so glad when this song comes around.
Yeah. I am too.
It's contrast. Not just the type of music, but the mood is contrast.
Mm-hmm. I think it would have been a great song to end with, but
I think the song they ended with is fantastic.
Yeah, I do too.
I love. So we're gonna are we ready to slide into Down the Dip?
Yep.
This is a contender for my favorite song on the album. I love this song.
Look at all the love and beauty in the spirit of the night, and I'm holding my ticket tight. Stupidity and suffering are on that ticket too, but I'm going down the dip with you. I swear I'm touched, but then I'm tired of everyone who tries to tie me.
This sounds like the one he plays when, after the first encore, he comes out and plays this while the band takes a little break.
good little kitchen table song, huh, Doug?
It's a great song.
I can't believe I forgot.
I've been listening to the CD, which
has three extra tracks.
It keeps going.
Yeah.
And those three extra tracks are great.
Yeah, they are.
I think this is a perfect way to end this album.
You know, I think I would do Back on Board for the end of the first one and this for the end of the second one. But this sounds like the end of the night.
Yeah,
it's time to. The lights are up a little bit. They're not all the way up.
Yep. Well, is this song about? It is about a place that he used to go. Right?
It's about a pub that he went to.
What was it? The Diplomat was
the Diplomat, school, or the they diplomat, called it the.
Yeah. That's a school. Yeah. Was the school he went to was something the, and its nickname was a Diplomat something, and this was down from there, I think.
No, the Diplomat was the pub.
Is that the pub?
Yeah, the school he went to was down the street from it, though. You're right about that.
Yeah.
His vocals are great on it. And I just love the fact it's just him and the guitar, and he's not doing anything. It's just, it's not a fancy guitar playing. It's just, I don't know.
It sounds like he did them both at the same time.
So yeah, I think it's a fantastic song.
Yeah, I really like this song. And
it keeps us from being categorized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's escaping all attempts to put him into a genre, because that's nothing that we've talked about already. It doesn't belong into any of those categories.
Right.
Yeah, and again, it's a difference. His guitaring style is different on this one. You can't say that's the Roddy Frame style of guitar. He has so many different styles.
That's true.
And he plays with a pick, and he plays without a pick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, guys. So that wraps up the album, right? Yeah. We're not going to talk about the extended version.
That you get on the CD.
Even though those are great songs.
It's interesting that Down on the Dips lyrics are excluded from this album.
Oh, that's
interesting. That's why I was thinking it was at the end of the... I was thinking, I didn't know Down on the Dip was the one of those that were only allowed on the... they were only on the CD.
Yeah.
But he didn't put the lyrics in there.
Interesting. So we talked a little bit about what people thought of this band. When you look at it, it's got 4 and 5 star reviews most places.
Yeah.
Got a positive review in the New York Times when it was released. Something you said, Doug, reminded me of this Cream review that said, "The world ain't perfect, but Highland Hard Rain comes close." It hit number 1 on the indie charts and number 22 on the UK album charts. These are both in the UK. It only peaked at number 129 on the Billboard Top 200. But it got heavy rotation on college radio. It was on alternative stations. And it made a lot of top 20 lists, end of year lists when it came out.
And a lot of musicians liked it.
A lot of musicians liked it, absolutely. I mean, we talked about Elvis Costello getting them to tour on the 1983 Punch the Clock tour. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing about that is, so Frame was 19 at the time, and some of the places they played, he had to lie about his age to get in to play them.
Wow.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's great. Can you imagine being 19 opening for Elvis Costello?
Well, how about being 19 and having Elvis Costello just reach out to you and say, "I love your music. I want you to open for me." There's a lot of times, there's lots of bands that get tapped, but to have him actually reach out.
At that time, who would have been better than Elvis Costello to say that about you?
Yeah, man.
It's songwriting, performing, guitar playing. It's amazing that he's not cited as an influence more than he is.
I know. Well, he's not just the most prolific guy in the world. I guess he started off that way, but he kind of took a big break for a while.
Right.
And his next album... He spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and for some reason...
I think he lived there.
Is that where he lived there?
Yeah.
And that's where he heard Bob Dylan's Infidels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he said, "Man, I really like that guitar sound. I really like the way this
sounds."
Who produced that? And that's how he got Mark Knopfler.
Infidels does have a great sound.
It does have an amazing sound.
It's unlike anything else Dylan ever did.
Yeah.
The production on that album, I love, and I would have been tempted to do the same thing.
Yeah,
and actually, Mark Knopfler said yes.
Yeah,
he did, and he's and Frame and the bassist were the only two guys left from the band at that point.
Well, then Knife has a whole bunch of people on it. He went from having a very small set of people to, I mean, if you look at the list of the people that played on Knife, it's pretty extensive. I mean,
worked with session players almost exclusively after that.
I don't think Mark Knopfler plays guitar on it, though.
Mark Knopfler to at least do one song?
He may not have credited
Maybe
himself,
Mark Knopfler wanted... I have a feeling that this was at the time of Mark Knopfler's life where he wanted to start being known as something besides a snazzy guitar player because he's branching out with... all kinds of things,
he's doing soundtracks and stuff.
Soundtracks.
Yeah.
I think he says, "What? Just because I'm a guitar player doesn't mean I'm not a composer of music." And I've come up with some pretty interesting production items.
Yeah,
he was obviously on Love Over Gold, he was more focused on the studio than almost anything else on that album. That's how it strikes me.
Yeah. And he was that soundtrack work that he did, you know, he makes a lot of use of synthesizers and keyboards
and his guitar makes a nice little appearance, but
nobody says that's a guitar album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think he moved away from the guitar consciously.
Well, yeah. And I actually, you know, I like Knife, I think, better as an album than I do.
I like the production.
I love the production on that.
Well, there's no synth drums on it.
There are no synth drums on it.
It's just, you know, when you get to heaven, like the third day, they take you to this record store. I said, "Oh, your favorite albums produced correctly. Go ahead. There's no limit. Yeah. And you have eternity to listen to." I can't wait.
Yeah.
All right. So do we want to give our reviews, guys?
Sound like a good idea.
All right. So, for anyone who's newly listening to us, we always give a review at the end of the album. We do two reviews. We do one that is our personal review, i.e. will we listen to the album regardless of anything else? And number two is sort of our critics review, which is regardless of how much we love it, where do we think this album stands in terms of other albums or just in general? So I am going to go to JM first since Doug picked this.
Okay, I'm going to go with my critics review first. It's a 4.0. It's just a refreshing album that came in the middle of what I thought, you know, if I were a critic, I would, in 1983, and this album came out, I would have jumped all over it and hyped this band as much as I could. So it's a 4.0 critically. Personal. I've been struggling with this. I like the playing on it a lot. I like the singing. Again, some of the production and mixing gets to me, and when I hear it against Knife, I just really kind of say Knife is a superior album. I like a lot of the stuff that he did after this. You know, I have a kind of a strange relationship with Aztec Camera because I hung around some people that absolutely loved this band, and I heard a lot of them. One of my favorite albums that they've done is probably their least popular album, Frestonia, which was the last one they did. It's difficult for me to figure out what I would listen to this album for again. I really, really like the songs, and I think that if Oblivious came on, I'd be going, okay, I want to hear the song after that. And then I would like if the song started, I would probably listen to the album again, but I don't see myself purposefully going out to put this album on. So I'm going to give it a 3.2 is my personal rating, but that could go up.
Okay. Well, I will do me next, since, as I said, this was a Doug pick. I agree with your critic's pick. I think 4.0 is a good, solid pick for this. I think there's some production issues. I think the drums date it. Some of the guitar dates it. Some of the background singing dates it. But, I mean, it's there. All the craft is there. Personally, this was fresh to me. I was not aware of this being in existence. I don't currently own it, but I will soon. I really like this album a lot. I will listen to it a lot, and happy to add it to my collection. So I'm going to give it a 4.5. Doug?
All right. So as a critic, I give it a 4.6. It loses points on production only. The songwriting here is very strong. If you told me that Elvis Costello wrote this in his 35th year, I would say, yes, I believe you. This is it's that strong. It's that mature of an album. And the fact that it's written by an 18-year-old baffles me. And the more I listen to it, the more baffled I am. Personally, I give it a 4.7. One of the reasons I like this album so much is because it is in contrast to everything else I own. So it's like reaching out for something completely foreign and different. And I love strong songwriters, and he's certainly one.
And, you know, we didn't talk enough about it, but I think his voice is really good.
I think his voice is good for this stuff. Yeah. And he gets, his voice gets better, I think, as he get as he gets older.
Well, yeah, and I think on even the songs we didn't talk about that were on the EP or on the extended version, you know who he reminds me of a little bit is from Crowded House.
Oh, Neil Finn.
Neil Finn. He has a Neil Finn.
Yeah,
he
does. Real, Neil Finn.
Real clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys. That was a fun one. I enjoyed listening to it, and I enjoyed talking about it and our little discussion about the various places we were in our youth. Yeah. It was fun. So this is the time when we normally do a review. I mean, not a review, a recommendation. I'm going to recommend an album tonight. It's one I probably should have recommended earlier. It's by one of my favorite Austin bands, the Belfuries, and it's their third album, Working Man's Belfuries. The reason I picked it is it's also kind of a tough to categorize genre-wise. There's a lot going on here that's great. It's a fantastic album, but it's you know, it's got a little bit of a kind of a jazziness to it. It's got a little bit of rockabilly. It's got some pop. So anyway, I'm going to play, the first song I'm going to play is Letter to My Maybe Baby, which is on that album. And to just give you a little taste of the spread of genres here, I'm going to play Bad Seed Sown also. Finally, I'm going to play An Illusion Believed. That's just kind of scratching the surface. It's a fantastic
stuff.
Album.
That's good.
That sounds like the Everly Brothers got transported.
Yeah, Joey Simeone, the lead singer, is a fantastic songwriter, fantastic vocalist.
And I love that upright bass. Do they always have an upright bass player? Is
he switches back and forth. But
sometimes
yeah.
He sleeps.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's Working Man's Belfuries. Obviously, a nod to the Dead album, Working Man's Dead. Released in 2015. If you don't have it, highly recommend it.
That's great stuff there. Thank you, Tony. Mm-hmm. And thank you, listeners, for letting us fill your airwaves with another edition of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. Tell your friends about us, especially if they like the long player format. We're available on most podcasting platforms. You can also visit our Facebook group page or email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our website, www.tappingvinyl.com. You'll find ways to listen to all our past episodes and find out ways to get our recommendations. There's also videos, pictures, and anecdotes of some of the artists that we've talked about. Next week, we're going to be listening to an album by the band Spirit and their classic, 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J. M. Rowe, thanks for listening, and happy birthday, T.
Thank you.
was.
You know what that outro needs is some synth drums.
Action.
All right.
You have to take the action.
This is part two? Or no, it's the same
thing. No, it's the same deal. It's just, yeah, anyway, that what you just said was a really good point, and I agree with it.
So I think, guys. Sorry, guys.
Saving on your education should be a right, not a competition.
That's really good.
That's so true.
You'll get the best scholarship or savings.
I heard it's the best. I'm a
god. Simple as that.
I don't know why.
Simple as that.
Explore scholarship options at University of Phoenix.
Okay. Okay, hold on. That was awesome.
They had a follow-up single.
Obvious.
Is it called Oblivious?
It's Oblivious.
Really? I thought it was called Obvious this whole time.
Really?
Yeah. No, I guess I should look at the record more.
And then
it's contrast, not just the type of music, but the mood is contrast. Mm-hmm. And it may have been better earlier, but I don't know.
I don't know.
Great like way to end.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not the end, though.
Is it? No, it's not the end.
No.
Down the dip.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I think it's a great, I think